Session number 12385, rule 12.
Yes. Yeah. Now, when we withdrew, we were under, we were feeling that once we'd withdrawn from Irun, we'd make a stand in San Sebastian. I should say it was about this time that, I don't know whether it was after or without my notes, I can't recollect. Do you want to...
Have you got your notes here?
Pardon?
Have you got your notes here?
I can get that, and they're in the back room.
Might be an idea.
Yes.
Yeah, hold on. Yeah. So, sorry.
Yes.
Give me those dates again, Bill.
No. Pardon?
Give me those. Could you give me those dates again, please?
Those names again?
Those dates again.
Oh, yes. Then, I think I mentioned that... we left Fort San, I'm just going backwards there, that when I arrived in Bilbao, I was organized in a column that went to free San Sebastian, although it was... in the hands of the Republic, there were still strongholds of the fascists holding out in the military headquarters and three hotels there. And then on July the 21st to the 25th, we had fighting in San Sebastian. And then... the column was enlarged, and it was changed to the called the Columna or Chandiano, which is a town in the Basque Country. And we advanced on Vitoria, which was the capital of that, which was held by the fascists, and then we. We captured a couple of small villages, Orchandiano and Abidia. That's where we got the name from. The Columna was led by Jesus Larinaga. He was the secretary for the Communist Party in the Basque provinces. Then we, on August the 1st, I was trying to remember these dates beforehand, we were transferred to the mountains in Tolosa. This is a recount of the previous dates, which I couldn't remember, from August the 1st to August the 11th, we were fighting and retreating all the time in the mountains from Tolosa, and then there was a very high mountain around there, which we held for a while, but we were driven off there by the bombing of the Italians and the Germans. It was called Mount Erlaitz, I think, E-R-L-A-I-T-Z. We were had to give up that strong point. And then we retreated there. And then we were in rest from the from August the 16th to the 19th. We went to have leave in San Sebastian. It was beautiful, sunny, warm weather, and we were sunbathing on the Playa de la Concha, which is a very big bay in San Sebastian, when we were fired on by the cruisers, España. Now, not us particularly, but the San Sebastian was... we were just on the beach, and we heard the reporter... of the guns firing out. Of course, we didn't see the ships. They were obscured by an island anyway in the bay, but we saw the explosions in the city. And then on the 20th of August, our leave was over and we were in the hills and mountains above Irun. And it was from August the 20th to September the 3rd that we were fighting in Irun, which I recounted earlier, this heavy fighting.
The fighting around Irun. Yeah.
Pardon?
The fighting in the mountains around Irun. Yeah.
No, the actual defense of Irun was we'd already retreated on the 20th just beyond Irun. There was several small hills there that we fortified and with sandbags, trenches, and so on. And it was this that I recounted earlier, that there's no need to go over that again. I recounted that earlier with the fighting, and we were gradually driven back. And then on the... that was... we were fighting for... from August the 20th to September the... third, so it was about 2 weeks we were fighting in defense of Irun there, that and that is when we saw the people on the French side coming down to watch us. I've forgotten the name of the town on the French side there, that especially at the weekends they came down to something like watching a bullfight, I suppose. And then it was on September the 1st that Columna was greatly enlarged again, and then the name changed to Perithagua. I don't know who Perithagua was, but I presume it's some patriot in Basque history or something.
And why? How was the column enlarged? What, Spanish people or...?
Oh, yes, because we were all, when you say, who was it, they would be Basques and Spanish mixed up. When I mentioned before that the Basque militia, it didn't mean to say that there weren't Basques in, we were all Basques in the Perithagua, but... there'd be Spanish-speaking Basques and so on. They'd be mostly the workers from Bilbao and San Sebastian and so on. That workers there would maybe many of them, although they'd. They were living in the Basque country. Many of them maybe couldn't speak Basque, just speak Spanish. So there was no differentiation. There'd be some pure Basques, Basque communists in our... for instance, I remember the Basque editions of the... of the communist newspaper, Mondo Obrero, which was published in Bilbao, was a bilingual paper. It was published in both Spanish and Basque.
Did you feel that there was ever any friction between the Basques nationalists and the communists at this time?
Oh, no, there wasn't any... except a slight superiority on our part. We felt that we were the shock troops and so on. But no, there was... if you met anyone in the Basque country, you didn't say, well, are you a Basque or are you Spanish? Because... you know, it's like people, what can you say, Scotch people that have grown up in England, that they are, they may be purely Basque. And at that time, there wasn't so much rivalry between the two governments, because, I mean, the rivalry that you get today between Basque and Spanish, you didn't have that then, because everyone was fighting for the same ideal, and even before the war started, they were both united in a struggle for independence of the Basque country, and the biggest fighters for that independence were the communists. So that that was the thing. And then perhaps I should say that when the name was changed to Parithagua on September the 1st, we then thought we were going into San Sebastian, that it would be fortified and we'd fight there. But I should perhaps digress a little bit here and mention that San Sebastian was held in some affection by the Spanish people, because it was a beautifully laid out town, except for the laid out city, except for the old fishing quarter, with wide avenues, and in fact it was the retreat of royalty during the summer months. The whole royal family from Spain used to get out of the oppressive heat in Madrid, used to transfer en bloc, and I believe also the government itself to San Sebastian, so that and the Basque government took on itself that that it would be declared an open city and all troops would be withdrawn from San Sebastian, and we were greatly enraged at this. And again, I think some anarchists did stop on and fought, but not much damage was done, and so on, because there were so few of them, and so on. So that it was on the 13th that we retreated from San Sebastian, and then we had numerous fighting in different parts of the Basque country from September the 13th, attacking and repulsing attacks in different towns and villages that I can't remember the names. And then on October the 1st, we were told to get ready, and the whole of our column with several other columns were sent to take Oviedo in the Asturias. So we went by these in cattle trucks to San Sebastian, cattle trucks and carriages and so on, troop trains mustered for the attack on Oviedo. And that was the first attack on Oviedo.
Phil, before we talk about that, can I just recap again?
Yes.
We were talking about fighting alongside the women before. We were talking about fighting alongside women before. There were a couple more questions I wanted to ask you about that.
Yes.
First of all, were they involved in all the same actions as the men? I mean, would they do as dangerous fighting as the men, or were they held back a bit, or what?
Oh, no, they would be, but by this time, in the fighting around Irun, and that actually is the last time I saw any number of women fighting there. They would be in the trenches alongside the men with dynamite bombs, with their with their rifles and so on there. But after that, they were gradually withdrawn. Although for a couple of weeks longer, we did have, I think, until the attack on Oviedo in October the 1st, very close friend of mine that I met in the battalion, that is just for the minute the name. Can you just? My friend Dolores, she stayed with the battalion. She was the last woman in our battalion.
Why were the women leaving the battalion?
Well, they would be found that it was too arduous, that they didn't leave the militia, but they would be given jobs as working in the stores, working in as typists and stenographers and that sort of thing, that that they'd be found different jobs. Many went into nursing and that sort of thing.
Do you think they were reluctant to leave, or do you not know? Or I change roles?
I wouldn't. No, I would think that. And although we see at the present time a reversal in the roles, where we find in the Gulf at the present time, we find American women fighting alongside the men. I feel that this is, and of course, it's a rather different war they're preparing for now, with mechanized things and so on. You don't need quite so much physical strength, but I would still think that at that time, when everything had to be manhandled and so on, that it was just getting too much for the women in the front line. And if they suggested, I don't think any command went out that they'd have to leave, but they would say that perhaps the commander would say to the, you know, that do you wish to take a job in the rear or something like that?
Did you ever see women involved in hand-to-hand fighting?
With what?
In hand-to-hand fighting.
Yes, except that you don't watch people in hand-to-hand. You don't say, well, I'll watch so-and-so with their hand, because all your concern with is saving yourself and trying to destroy the enemy, so that yes, there were some scattered along the trenches from me, but whether they were the only one I particularly noticed would be Dolores, because we were always together at that time, I couldn't tell you. I don't think possibly she was a small girl. She wouldn't have the physical strength to stick a bayonet into someone, but she had a machine pistol and so on, that sort of thing, and also a rifle, so that I saw her using that. And of course, when we were in foxholes together, that we're you're just trying to get as close to the earth as possible to escape the bombing. But apart from that, I didn't notice the others particularly. So that, and then when we went to Oviedo, she was taken out. I think she was the last in the entire Perithagua column, Dolores, and she was sent on some mission to Victoria. some secret mission, some probably completely useless and stupid, but she was wounded on the way back and died shortly afterwards. So that,
Was there a routine to your day when you were fighting around Iran? Was there a stand to in the morning and that sort of thing, or what can you remember?
Was there any?
A routine to your day?
Oh,
at all?
No routine at all. You just, you know, there couldn't be any routine. When you were in the trenches, you were fortifying them all the time with sandbags and digging and making them deeper and sort of making them as strong as possible against the enemy.
How about a stand to in the morning? Did you have a stand to in the morning?
Well, you'd have different watches that if it was quiet at night, then the you'd have the guards posted all the time, and not only guards posted, but scouts going out to see if anyone was infiltrating and that sort of thing. So and the enemy were doing the same. So you had all this scattered shooting and so on, isolated shooting, but nothing much.
And how did you find sleeping? Were you able to sleep?
Yes, we were comparatively young, and you were just so tired out, you just dropped and slept just where you were. That there was no question of undressing or anything like that when you were in the lines. That some people remove their boots, but mostly we were fighting in what they called alpargatas, that is wooden-soled rope-soled sandals, which laced up round the legs, so you just kick those off. But I was always a little bit frightened of night attacks, so I just take them off for a short while, but when I went to sleep, I always kept my shoes on there, so that you were ready instantly for any trouble.
But it was September, wasn't it? So it would have been. Was it cold at night?
Oh no! This was beautiful weather there at September. It can be very rainy in the Basque Country later on, but it varies a lot, and you get some rain in the summer in the Basque Country, but this summer was particularly, I think they remarked on it, it was a beautiful summer there. It was warm, and September was very, very a good, right through to September. And I think right through to the attack on Oviedo. Then when we got to Oviedo, which the fascists, it's a stronghold of the miners of the Asturias, and they were only able to take the city by subterfuge, by the army commander declaring for the Republic and saying he was dispatching the miners off to try and save Madrid. And then when they marched out, the army took over, so that was in their hand. But the first attack on Oviedo with the miners there and organized in their own Asturian battalions, and also for those from Santander and the Basque provinces. At one time, we did manage to take advance as far as the cathedral and held the cathedral for a few hours, But then we were driven out again, and we were just... and then we more or less encircled... not encircled, but a half-circle, because all to the south was in the hands of the fascists. But we'd half-encircled Oviedo, and we were there. Again, we dug in trenches on a hill looking down on Oviedo. As far as I recollect, the hill was about 300 or 400 foot high or something like that. We had trenches around the crest of the hill and trenches in depth to the back of the thing. And there... I had a nasty experience I don't want to dwell on, particularly on my own part in the... what happened is we were there and we were very, very scared about... because we imagined we'd listen... to the earth, and we'd imagine that the fascists were tunneling underneath us and ready to plant dynamite and blow the whole top of the hill off. But then we're somewhat reassured is the fact that all the miners were very, very anti-fascist, and no way would they could be brought in to do that. But even so... we had many qualms about that. It was probably just hearsay and so on there. And then the armourer for the unit got wounded, and because there was no one else there, they said, well, you'll have to act as temporary armourer, that's to me. And at this time, we'd... and for some time previously, we'd been getting proper hand grenades, either the ones with just the ordinary ones they had in the British and Canadian armies. You just pulled out the pin and held the handle and then threw it. That had happened a long time, and for quite a few weeks we'd had this... But before that, as an advance on the dynamite bombs, these homemade hand grenades of cans, of bean cans filled with dynamite, we'd been having proper hand grenades, but instead of with a pin and a handle, just a fuse, which again you had to light and then throw. But that, we hadn't seen those for some weeks. And then when it came up, by this time we had many, many ferocious attacks up this hill from the... and they lost... we had barbed wire staked in front of our trenches and all down this hill, very, very steep hill coming up. But the Moorish troops seemed to... they just threw themselves at the barbed wire and were caught on the barbed wire and mown down with our machine guns. And and the Foreign Legion also. And when the feud did manage to break through, we always held them off with our hand grenades, the normal type of hand grenades with the pin and so on. But when they said, well, you'll take over the armourer's job, that was one of the jobs included the big wooden boxes containing these hand grenades were brought up, each in its separate compartment, very heavy with a couple of rope handles, and we'd hollowed out in front of the trench a sort of minor dugout where we put these boxes of hand grenades so that they wouldn't be, if any hand grenade was tossed into the trench, they wouldn't be set off either. And then one night we had a terrific attack by these. I was sort of in charge of these hand grenades, but we were so tired out there. We've been standing by and in these trenches there that we'd built. I suppose they were about 5 foot deep or 6 foot deep. I can't remember now. But I opened the lid of the box and saw they were the ordinary hand grenades, and then shoved them under there. And then when the attack came and they burst through the... also, they used some artillery pieces to shatter some of the barbed wire, and they came through, and I opened the boxes and then handed out these things. I thought they were dozens and dozens of hand grenades with the